a vast forest of white oaks on a hill overlooking the Potomac River and all of Washington. Fun fact, it was Confederate General Robert E. Lee's plantation before the Civil War until Union Army General Montgomery Meigs took it over and created the cemetery.
Yeah, so we're right here, that right past there is Lee's house.
Robert E. Lee.
Yeah, Robert E. Lee had his house. Actually, you can drive since we got some time. We go around the circle. Montgomery Meigs buried all these unknowns in Robert E. Lee's rose garden, so he would never come back. It was like more like a, hey, fuck you. Right there is, if you want to go walk up to it.
Wow.
So, the cemetery's on 624 acres, so probably that or more. I'm not sure what the original layout.
That's almost a square mile.
Square mile, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I have to go explore. Unless it does rain.
Should we have a drink at my dad's grave and talk?
Sure, yeah.
Rob spent 6 months living in a tent in the Appalachian Mountains, where he felt he was doing the work JPAC had failed to do. Rob was creating a massive database of all the soldiers buried as unknowns in 24 U.S. military cemeteries abroad. That meant vetting thousands of pages of files and inputting their records into a spreadsheet, and it meant hundreds of hours of his own time over several years.
So set the scene. You're in the tent. Are you doing this by candlelight or lamplight? Or
It's just like solar power light. And I have solar power generator. So
you had a panel?
I have my computer, and it's hooked up to it. I put it in this mission like a regular job, honestly. Like, I remember when I was even on active duty, I would come home. You know, I'd come home at like 6 o'clock, cook dinner or cook something up real quick, and I'd go hit it until like midnight. So at least 6 hours. And plus the entire weekends, just doing research. So I go through the burial files, and those have details of the burials of the individual that was found. So the precise locations that I was getting, estimated like the unit, what kind of like material evidence was found, types of like evidence that could be used for identification further. So like height of the individual, dental records, dental charts. Basically, I created a very extensive database off of each of the unknowns.
7,000?
8,700. Plus, I did this for Korea prior to that.
Some of these files, the ones I looked at, they're 30, 40 pages.
Pages, right. Some of them are like 100, some of them like 20 pages, and it doesn't even give you a name association.
These are called X-files by the military. They include dental charts and other records created in 1949. When the remains from the temporary cemetery on Okinawa were exhumed. Those men were reburied at either the Manila American Cemetery in the Philippines or at the Punch Bowl in Hawaii. The records can be used to identify these anonymous soldiers. The headstones are marked only with numbers, no names. And they're engraved with the phrase, "Here rests in honored glory a comrade in arms known but to God." Rob's personal mission was to help find them.
We're the only country on the planet that actively and proactively searches for the remains that are still out there, that are missing, unaccounted for our war dead. You go over to England, the UK, if they find the remains, you know, they find like World War I or World War II remains, and they can't associate it with anybody, they kind of give up, and they bury it as an unknown. Now, we send them to our lab, and we try every current scientific method available to try to identify that individual.
Back in 2012, Rob became an investigator and field researcher for History Flight, an independent nonprofit that brings home missing soldiers. When JPAC claimed the bodies of about 500 Marines were unrecoverable on the Pacific island of Tarawa, History Flight went there with shovels. Rob joined them in 2015 to help dig up remains. Then he came back home and went to college.
When we went to Tarawa, we were pulling out feet. Like, we would find a burial trench, and we'd find nothing but boots and feet. It's like, holy shit. We were able to reconnect this unknown to remains that we recovered on Tarawa. Based on, like, the angle the tibia and fibula were cut.
From the start, Rob believed that Mulligan's body had not vanished. He was certain that Mulligan was one of the 207 X-Files in his database from the Battle of Okinawa. I asked about his unusual obsession with recovering the missing war dead. It all began with a school project about his great uncle Donald.
I was 13, 14. Yeah. But I remember the date when it all started, when this all started. April 25th, 2003. I was on spring break. My mom was teaching. I was home alone. And I had just done a genealogy project on my family. And I had no idea who this Donald Sang guy was. Totally different last name as my grandfather. He was a half-brother. My mom thought he was in the Navy when he was killed. So I'm like thinking, oh, this guy's never going to be found. He was, you know, he was lost at sea. So I started doing a research on the unit that he was in and just started to find out he was on a B-24 that was shot down in Germany.
Rob wanted to understand what happened to Donald. So when he got older, he went to Germany to interview any witnesses he could find.
And so it just started from there. Like, it snowballed. Eventually went over to Germany, interviewed the individual who was 80 when I interviewed him. But he was a teenage boy when it happened. I mean, he saw the aircraft was broken in half, and he saw the tail section coming down. He saw two guys come out. Their parachutes were dangling. It was out of the harness. And
but too low elevation.
Too elevation to open, yeah. And it coincided with another witness in a report from 1946. Come to find out, like, he's buried in France. So I was like, no way.
How old were you when you interviewed that fella?
2013, so 22, 23.
To say you're obsessed would be an understatement.
Right.
Rob found the daughter of Sergeant Dale Holker, one of the survivors who was able to get out of the plane at a high enough elevation for his chute to open. Sergeant Holker told his daughter that Donald saved his life. He pushed him out of the plane first.
He died in 1998, when I was not even a year old. And he was seeing a psychologist at the time in the late 80s before he passed away. And he was asked by his psychologist to draw a picture of the best day of his life and then a picture of his worst day of his life. The best day of his life is the wedding. The worst day of his life was when he was shot down. And he draws a picture of my great uncle strapping a parachute to him and pushing him out of the aircraft and pulling the ripcord as it goes out. My great uncle definitely saved a life, and the daughter of the waste gunner told me that they're existing now because of my great uncle. My grandfather never knew that.
Rob became really emotional when he talked about his grandfather, because his grandfather struggled for decades with the loss of his brother, Donald. Like my dad, he kept a photo of him out, and now Rob has it.
So, that's one story of sacrifice. Times that by, you know, 70 plus thousand missing, because they all have their story.
Just explains a lot about what drives you.
That sacrifice, that you had every opportunity to save your own ass, but to give it up. You can't repay that. None of those guys got to marry. None of those guys got to have kids, live their lives. And that's kind of the drive. It's like, nothing that I will ever do for these guys will ever make up for that.
In order to present an ironclad case that Mulligan was in his X-Files, Rob studied those 207 records and compared them to Mulligan's profile. Height 5'8", age 22, approximate date of death, late May 1945. Mulligan's dental charts were especially important. The pattern of fillings and teeth are kind of like a fingerprint. Before DNA testing, they were the main factor in proving identity. Back in the day, dental charts were just a blank depiction of a typical mouth, and each soldier's fillings were marked in ink by hand. Jean Patterson then learned how to read dental records, and she went through dozens of those files looking for close matches. We needed to identify a very short list of possibilities for the DPAA, the agency that replaced JPEG, before they could exhume any grave.
My name is Fern Sumpter Winbush. I'm the Principal Deputy Director for the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA. I am responsible for all of the support that goes behind the field ops that we conduct and the laboratories.
The DPAA is ramping up these searches. The current annual rate is nearly three times as many as when I first contacted the now-defunct JPEC. Could they identify more than 7,000 soldiers buried as unknowns from World War II?
This year, in fact, we, for the first time, accounted for 203.
Fiscal year.
Our director has charged us to push to 350. And so we are in the process now of building the capability and capacity to get there. The chances of us identifying all of them is probably slim, to be frank. But right now, it's only limited by current technology. Who knew 30 years ago that we'd be pulling DNA out of a bone and making an identification? So, you know, where the prudent side of me says, you're probably not going to be able to identify all 8,000, the very positive side of me says, really, sky's the limit. And we might just get to all 8,000. You just don't know.
Dr. Gregory Kupski, a DPAA historian who specializes in World War II, explained their investigative process.
Well, the historian's job is to participate both in the effort to find and identify missing servicemen and also to convey whatever information we have on missing service members to the family members and to the public. So in addition to the physical evidence, obviously, before we can get to that point, you need to use anything you can to reconstruct the historical record, which means we look through not just files related to that individual, but also unit records or, in some cases, local records. So, for example, once when I was in Germany on a mission, I stopped at the city archives of Magdeburg, where there was a diary written by a teenager who was working in a flak station in Magdeburg. And so he was saying, on such and such date at such and such time, we shot down three B-17s and they landed here, here, and here. Now, he doesn't know who's on those, but we might be able to figure it out. And now we have locations to look for bombers that we know went missing on that day, for example. In addition, we interview local residents. So it's pretty interesting to see the various types of evidence that can come together to put us on the trail that leads us to a recovery that hopefully leads to an identification.
The final hurdle to get an exhumation is DNA. But just having DNA from James Patterson wasn't going to be enough for us. In Mulligan's case, the DPAA needed six close matches that fit his profile.
We have to have a certain amount of the DNA family reference samples on hand before we finally submit the proposal. So in this case, if you have six individuals on that list, we need to have 50% because it's one X-file.
In other words, if Rob and Jean could come up with six likely matches for Mulligan, the DPAA would need to have the DNA on file for three of those cases. That DNA would come from the cheek swabs of relatives of those other missing soldiers. The odds seemed impossible. What happened in 2016 is a long story, but here's the short version. Rob created a 37-page report which argued that Mulligan was almost certainly an unknown soldier buried as X-35. Like Mulligan, X-35 was killed in action on Okinawa in late May 1945. Then in 1949, the body was transferred from the temporary grave on the island to the Manila American Cemetery in the Philippines. X-35 was missing his lower jaw. Rob found three dentists who volunteered their expert opinions on the fillings in the few remaining upper teeth. X-35's fillings were a close match to the ones in Mulligan's dental chart.
It's just all about, you know, data at that point. You've taken all the people out of it. And then once that, you know, that foundation is set, you know, then you start to work on, like, the human side of the story.
James Patterson submitted Rob's report to the DPAA and formally requested that X-35 be disinterred. We waited and waited. Months later, the agency informed us that they would disinter at the end of May 2017. Time was critical. James Patterson had been diagnosed with lung and bladder cancer, and the disease was advancing.
Once the remains are brought into the lab and the samples are cut, they're sent to the Armed Forces Medical Examiner system, or the Armed Forces DNA, AFDIL, for identification. And it is a matter of putting the sample through a machine that does magic. And unfortunately, the magic is not always so quick.
Fern Winbush, who's a retired U.S. Army commander, explained that the first DNA test failed because the bones had most likely been treated with formaldehyde. This destroyed a lot of X-35's DNA and delayed the process. Their scientists had to resort to a very intricate method, the same kind used on 3,000-year-old Egyptian mummies. On July 3, 2017, James died.
Hi, Dale. It's Jean. Give me a call back, please, when you get a minute, as soon as you can. Thanks. Bye.
Almost 1 year after James's death, I woke up to this message on my phone from Jean Patterson. This was the news I'd waited 18 years to hear. X-35 was Herman Mulligan.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, my God. So, I'm just speechless. I was telling somebody the other day, you never get a chance to finish your father's unfinished business.
Exactly.
My dad is singing somewhere right now.
And James is up there with him, too.
Oh, Gene, I'm floating.
I know. I am, too. I've been pacing.
Oh, wow.
Every piece was part of the puzzle. Every piece. It is a miracle.
I want to personally thank you. I mean, just me, the citizen, not Dale, the journalist. It means a lot to me what you guys did and what everybody else did. I felt everybody carried me across the finish line, you know?
It took all of us, me, Bridget, Jean, James, Rob, and finally the DPAA, to bring Mulligan home, and a lot of luck. And Dr. Kupski said more families are going to get good news like this in the next few years.
For about a year, we've had a project aimed specifically at unknowns from Okinawa. Currently, our project has an estimate of about 170 unknowns that we believe are losses that occurred onshore on the island of Okinawa. Once we've finalized the write-up and once we've submitted it within DPAA for approval, that's when we start trying to collect DNA against that project. You know, and it's kind of a mix of families who have been waiting for years and, of course, families who are contacted for DNA and might not even know that they have a loved one who's missing.
I was surprised how many families are still searching for their missing relatives from World War II, even great-grandchildren.
As a World War II historian, what's interesting to me is when I tell friends and family members about what I do for a living, a lot of times they might say, well, sure, for Vietnam or even Korea, where it's a little more recent and maybe a little more relevant to families, but do you really get World War II families who are that emotionally invested in the missing from almost 80 years ago? And when we have our family update meetings, anybody who's been to one will tell you absolutely that's the case. And so even though we still do get siblings of the missing who come to these who still want to know what happened to their siblings during World War II, but even the next generation down, a lot of times now we'll meet with nephews and nieces who say, my mother is too ill to travel to this meeting, but before she dies, she wants to know where her brother is. And so you can see the emotion in these families and you can see how important this is to them even now. So you can tell that even for World War II, as long ago as it was, this is still very, very central to the histories of these families and to the emotions of these families.
I understood that emotion. I was happy for the Pattersons, but I was also sad. Sad that my dad wasn't alive to share the news. Sad that James didn't make it to see his cousin come home. When I first talked with James and Jean back in 2014, they wondered what would happen if we got lucky and Herman was identified.
Now, what would they do? Would they leave the remains there, or would they bring them back to the States?
I think they would do whatever you wanted. My dad's at Arlington National Cemetery. He said, I got a Purple Heart. I can be buried there. And that would seem to be his wishes, and so we honored him. I think, I'm not sure, you could leave him there or you could bring him back to the States or put him in, if there's a family plot, I think you can do that.
With the Purple Heart, could they bury him at Arlington?
Yeah, absolutely. My father's buried.
Yeah, that would be great.
The Pattersons wanted Mulligan buried as close to his friend Steve Maharidge as possible.
Thank you. Hello.
Jean, how are you?
So good to see you.
Hey, yes.
Yes.
Put that hair down.
It's okay.
Hey, we're equal. We have enough, as many dogs as there are people.
Rob and I visited Jean to help plan out the details of the funeral.
September would be good. That would be fine.
Yeah, but maybe November possibly.
Does it get cooler up there at November?
September's good. Because it's fall and it's Arlington Cemetery. It's all oak trees.
Beautiful. Oh, it'll be pretty.
Okay. Very beautiful, changing of the leaves.
And I only wrote down the one, Section 12, Site 387.
That's the best one.
Yeah.
And that's four graves over.
And I know there's another one, but you don't know for sure.
Plot 387 was just four graves away from my parents in Section 12. Rob and I went to the cemetery to scope out the empty site. Between that plot and my parents was John Bassalone, the only Marine in World War II who won both the Medal of Honor and the Navy Cross, the U.S. military's two highest awards. Bassalone died during the Battle of Iwo Jima in 1945. Rob pointed to the vacant grave on the right.
One right here, and then, like, there's one right there.
Oh, there's no stone.
No, yeah, so we're thinking that this one doesn't have anybody here. Right here, there's nothing here.
Boy, if this could be the one.
Right.
Wow. It's, let me see how far. It's
like 50 feet.
20 tops, between 15 and 20. Wow.
So this one off, this next one doesn't really offer a good view because of the trees, but this next one offers a view straight to the Washington Monument. So if you're standing right
there. Oh wow, yeah.
Even when it's full, but you can see it right here.
Oh wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. Right.
Boy, that's the one.
Right.
Let's see who's next to.
Later that year, we went back again with a bottle of good bourbon.
Bottled in 2017.
Respectable
bourbon.
As per the hobo rule, the first drink goes to the people down below the ground. Here's for you, Dad.
The dead drink first. Something I'd learned from the old Great Depression-era hobos when I rode the rails back in the early 1980s.
Isn't that good? Expensive.
18 years in the making. It could have gone wrong in 100 different ways. Your dad could have just, like, said, fuck it, I don't want to ever see it.
I wouldn't know.
You wouldn't ever know. Exactly. Yeah. But a nation who forgets its dead will cease to exist.
When you said, like you said, do you want to come? It's like, fuck you. I'm you can't keep me awake.
I was hoping you'd come, but I wasn't. I didn't want to put pressure on you, you know? People think I should be really happy. I'm not happy about this.
No.
I have not been sleeping the last week. I've been depressed. I've been clenching my teeth still.
Oh, my God. I'm thinking my bridge is going to fall out.
Yeah.
I'm here for healing.
Click to that, man. That's really what it's about.
Chapter 6, The Funeral.
On August 21st, 2018, Herman Walter Mulligan would finally be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, 18 years after I started searching for him. He'd get full military honors, which meant there'd be horses, a band, and a rifle platoon. And we expected dozens of people to show up. Mostly Mulligan's family, but also Bridget Carroll, Rob Rumsby, my Uncle Bobby, and a few other relatives of mine. I was really hoping my brother Daryl would come, but I wasn't sure he'd make it. We hadn't been in touch for weeks. Sometimes we go years without talking. So I was relieved when he texted me.
So you say healing. What do you think's going to heal by seeing Mulligan tomorrow, get his service?
I'll find out tomorrow. I don't know. Look how many people are coming. I didn't expect.
Vince, Babe's kid, he's here. Jenny's here, our cousin.
I thought Bobby and Karen were here for something else.
No, they came for this, man. And where do you meet the Pattersons tomorrow? They're sweet people. Oh, my God. And Bob Patterson, who lost his leg in Vietnam, he's beside himself happy. He's going to wear his uniform tomorrow. You know, this means a lot for the Pattersons, and that means a lot to me.
By God, it seemed like forever it was going to take. Now we're here. Tomorrow, we're going to do this thing.
Yeah.
And I'm just ecstatic. Ecstatic.
So we're going to see you in uniform tomorrow.
The only thing that I was disappointed in was the ribbons are not exactly like I wanted. I mean, I've got them on the shirt and everything, but...
Can I ask how much it cost?
I think originally it was like $328 or something. I got it for $305 or something. Yeah, like
something
that.
Off of it.
Yeah, my wife kept saying, why can't you just go buy a pair of black shoes somewhere? I said, no. Why can't you? No. I'm wearing my uniform.
That box right there, what's that? It's got your hat?
That's got my hat in it.
Robert Patterson drove 5.5 hours to a military store to buy that new dress uniform. He kept his white hat in the box until the day of the service.
Why is this exciting for me? First of all my kids are going to be here except for my youngest son who could not get off of work. My middle daughter's driving in tonight after she gets off of work from Ohio with her two sons. My oldest son's going to be here. I mean, this is just a family thing. And then all of the people that I have met or been in contact with since I'm the PNOC now, I wasn't sure what that meant until they explained to me.
Personal next of kin.
Yeah. But I have tried to find the words to thank everybody, especially for my dad, for my Uncle James. And my dad would just be jumping up and down. You wouldn't be able to contain him right now. I can guarantee you. That red hair would be flying in the wind. He would just be up and down. It's just mind-boggling. I mean, it took this many people working together as a family to get this moment to come together for tomorrow. And I'm just, I don't know if I can sleep tonight.
The next morning, we all met in the hotel lobby. I spotted Joe Lanciotti in a wheelchair. I was stoked to see him. He and his daughter, Vivian, took the train down from New Jersey. They were both wearing really cool hats.
Thanks. It's good to see you. You're looking great.
Yeah. Well, I never thought we'd see this day.
That's true.
You know? And you're the only guy from the company who's going to be here that I know of.
What do you think?
Morning, Gene.
You're the only guy who's going to be here from the Love Company.
Yeah. I'm glad I made it.
I'm really glad.
I'm glad I made it.
You know, the real
story. You lost weight.
Thanks for noticing.
Yeah, I know.
Joe is 93 years old now. Of the four guys still alive from Love Company, he was the only one who could be there. The other three were too sick to come.
Joe Lanciotti, this is Bob Patterson.
How are you, sir?
How you doing?
It is an honor and a pleasure to meet you.
It's a pleasure to see you with the old uniform.
Well, it don't fit like it used to.
I wouldn't wear mine.
You know, this whole thing has just been so exciting for me. And I really wanted to meet you. My dad and Herman were like brothers. They grew up together. And so to meet somebody that actually served with Herman, you know, it's an honor.
I'm glad I met you.
Yeah.
We were surrounded by Mulligan's family. They were all just as excited as Robert.
My name is Regina Maley. I'm the daughter of Robert Patterson.
Rhonda Mitchell.
I am Herman's second cousin.
Corporal Elizabeth Bumbarger. I am, I believe, the fourth cousin to PFC Mulligan.
I come from a long line of military, so it's important to me just to be able to see the respect that Herman is getting after being, you know, killed in action, missing for all these years, and finally being home. I didn't personally know him, but my dad has said that that's the reason my grandpa became a Marine. And that's the reason, you know, probably my dad became a Marine, you know, and the rest of our kin has followed suit. They're all in the military in some branch. And just to see the honor that Herman is getting is great. I drive school bus, and my boss made it out to be a big deal. And I knew at that moment I wasn't going to go back to that job. And I didn't. I found another job. I quit because they wouldn't let me come to Arlington.
Robert's sister Rhonda was convinced there was one more Patterson there in spirit. She told me she was spooked by something that happened last night.
So, last night, went downstairs to the little gift shop. I told him I wanted a Coke and a Diet Coke. And I told her just to put it in a bag. We went back upstairs. And my mom said, do you know what it says on this Coca-Cola? You know, they have names on them, right?
She's talking about the Share a Coke campaign with the names printed on bottles.
I just grabbed a bottle, so I didn't even look. One bottle said Willis, and the other bottle said Robert. My dad's Willis Robert Patterson. That. I said, well, my dad is here. He is a part of this story.
I knew my husband's spirit was there. A lot of people don't believe me, but I know what I know.
Robert's fiery 89-year-old mother, Ruby Langley Patterson, remembered stories Willis told her about Mulligan.
My husband talked about Dick all the time. That was his buddy he grew up with. So, you know, felt like I knowed him. I seen those pictures that my husband had of him. So, very emotional, you know. I just wish my husband could live long enough to see him bring him home. He wanted him so bad to get back to the States, you know, where he belonged. And I feel like he knows it now. It's an honor that they bring him home. I know it took a good while, but it's like the Marines always say, they don't leave their own behind. For the grace of God, they found him, and he's finally come home to rest.
The family and I really pushed for Mulligan to be buried near my parents. We'd sent letters pressuring our congressmen and senators, but it didn't work. That morning, Jean Patterson got a text in the hotel lobby saying Mulligan would be 300 feet away, the length of a football field. Officials never explained why. In the end, all that mattered is that Mulligan was home. But Jean was sad that James didn't live long enough to see his cousin buried.
I think we were sitting at the table one day, and we had the Purple Heart and the dog tag because I had it in a little dome. You know, and he said, I wish that I had known about him sooner because we could have maybe helped sooner. You don't know. We had those pieces sitting in the hall for years. I don't know where they came from except that his mom had given them to him. And nobody ever really said anything about him until, you know, you and I started talking and James and Bridget and everybody. We didn't know anything about Herman.
The funeral would take place in the early afternoon. Before that, Rob Rumsby had arranged for a wreath-laying ceremony in Mulligan's honor at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. It's a monument for the unidentified American servicemen killed in World War I, World War II, and Korea. One man from each war is buried there to represent all unknown soldiers.
Good luck, all right, ladies and gentlemen, go ahead and load on the bus if you're for the Mulligan service. If you fall in formation, raise your right hand and give me 4 more years to the Corps. Rob, going down to the right.
A white bus pulled up in front of our hotel to take everybody over to the tomb. It's a sacred plaza that sits on a hill overlooking Arlington National Cemetery.
Okay, we just got off the bus. This is going to be the wreath laying ceremony. We're at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and the family is going to lay a wreath of white flowers in Herman's name at the tomb.
Patty. Patty. Which way?
As we walked up, our group fell silent. It's very difficult to become a tomb sentinel, one of the highest honors in the Army. Two sentinels are on duty 24 hours a day. They start by walking 21 steps south, then face east for 21 seconds, then north for 21 seconds, and a bunch more things that by tradition involve the number 21. Then back to the start. Uniforms are custom-made and measured to 1/64th of an inch. You have to have deep knowledge of Arlington and be able to recite it verbatim.
Ladies and gentlemen, the ceremony that you are about to witness
is an Army wreath laying ceremony to be conducted by the Mulligan family. Thank you.
The presenters were Robert Patterson and his son Chris, who's a former Army PFC, along with Robert's granddaughter, Elizabeth Baumbarger, a former Marine corporal. Rob, who served in the Army, also joined them, even though he's not family. Their footsteps echoed through the plaza as they walked down the marble stairs towards one of the sentinels. Because of his missing leg, Robert was scared that he might fall. They laid the wreath and shared a few words with the sentinels.
Ceremonies like that are very important to us. And I would like to say on behalf of all the sentinels, thank you for coming out here to lay a wreath at 2 weeks. As of now, you're released, and I hope you have a wonderful day here in Harlem, despite the rain.
Thank you. We appreciate you.
Minutes after presenting the wreath, Robert couldn't contain his feelings. He broke the rule of silence.
I don't know why they want always put stamps places. I said, he was trying to trick me up. I said, I'm not going to follow any steps. That's all there is to it.
Takes your breath away. It really does. I mean, especially when you're standing right down there, too, you know. I think the nerves are going out of me now. It's just the excitement of it all. You know, it's just the honor of it. You know, it's...
All visitors will maintain an atmosphere of silence and respect at all times.
After being admonished, we all got back on the white bus and returned to the hotel. It began to rain.
Get on the bus. Okay. Go back to the hotel.
Oh, okay.
And then they'll bring us back over here.
Yeah, you have to walk that way. Yeah, that, you need to come around.
We're going to go down that way?
Yeah.
And get that car.
I have to stop from being emotional. Because in talking to you, I can become very emotional. I really don't want to. I know as I get older and closer to packing in, I'm getting closer to the end. And I never had this before, but I'm having more and more visions of what happened then. I can get emotional thinking about my friends. I can see all of them. I think over the years, Steve... that I've been putting that in back of my mind, but now time is saying, screw you, they're coming forward. And they are. I have to stop it, otherwise I'll just start bawling.
Yeah.
I have to stop it.
Joe Lanciotti had to go to his room to rest before the funeral. This was a tiring trip for him. We didn't get to talk much in the hotel, but I thought about our many conversations over the years.
There are many battles, many battles. Each individual experiences maybe a battle by himself. Sometimes he shares it with many people. Sometimes it's only a few people. So in one battle, there are many battles. So what people remember is what they experience. What I say, how I compare it, is like somebody blind touching an elephant, and you touch the nose and you say, oh, it's a snake, and you touch the tail and you say it's a worm. It all depends what you see and what you feel, what the battle is.
I think he meant this both literally and figuratively. My dad's battle never ended. He could never see the whole elephant. He didn't want to. On the other hand, Joe tried to see it. He consumed books about the war. He learned that the famous General Douglas MacArthur was critical of the Battle of Okinawa.
They know, if you read General MacArthur, the big guru of warfare, says Okinawa was not necessary. You tell that to 100,000 Japanese troops, you tell that to 120,000 civilians, to 30,000 Marines, what have you, an army, it's not necessary. I thought we needed those airfields.
There were several huge errors. Obviously, number one, we didn't understand the Japanese defensive plan. They misunderstood how many men were on the island. They also misunderstood what kind of weapons the Japanese had. So they didn't really understand what kind of damage the Japanese could do to the attacking forces. So that screwed a lot of things up, just to put it bluntly.
Dr. Jeffrey Moore, the defense analyst who consults with the Pentagon, the Army, and other agencies, said the U.S. Navy simply didn't understand what it was getting into on the island. It wasn't just hindsight or the so-called fog of war. There were major mistakes by intelligence officers that could have prevented so much bloodshed.
The intelligence agency that was supporting this massive effort did not produce intelligence to what they specifically referred to as quote-unquote apple polishing perfection. And when you're not producing intelligence to apple polishing perfection, you're getting it as good as you can. You're getting the best picture of the enemy situation that you possibly can. And you're going to war, brother. That's it. You are running into the gauntlet with the best that you've got.
Dr. Moore reminds us there are critical lessons to remember today. 80 million people died in World War II. Don't think it can happen again.
We lost a lot of men in this war, and so did the Japanese. And if we are cavalier about this kind of thing, looking at what might be in store for us with regards to China, we've got another thing coming. We could fight a war like that again tomorrow in North Korea. And nowadays we have missiles that are a lot more accurate and destructive than they were even in Desert Storm with our Tomahawk missiles and whatnot. This kind of thing could happen again, and the casualties could be even worse. People have forgotten, and they look back at World War II as an iconic victory, and they don't get down into the weeds and the details about what it actually took to win.
How humanity will ever get away from having wars, I don't know. I used to think it would be possible. Today, I don't think. We all thought technology would make it impossible to have wars, but technology seems to be expediting wars and making it even more sanitary and quick. But still, people die. And it's usually the little people, the poor people, die. And they're the ones who suffer. I think most American people, Marines, soldiers, whatever, remember the way I do. I'm not that unique.
We got back on the white bus. This time we headed to the cemetery for Mulligan's funeral. The rain was suddenly intense. It came down with biblical fury. It was like a monsoon in the tropics. There were thunderclaps, lightning flashes. As the rain sheeted down, the casket was loaded onto a caisson drawn by six black horses. A 21-piece band played. We all wanted to walk behind the caisson, but it was raining so hard, we had to get back on the bus. The bus followed the horses down winding lanes through the cemetery. Mulligan's casket was carried to the gravesite. There was an escort rifle platoon standing at attention. All of the soldiers wore white caps, white pants, dark woolen coats that reached below their knees. They didn't have rain gear or umbrellas. They just stood there like statues, unflinching. A soldier shouted an order.
Hand, salute.
I was startled by the gunfire. Seven riflemen reloaded and fired again. And again, 21 shots. A soldier began taps. The bugle call used at dusk, and for the dead. Robert held his mother Ruby as she wept. His head hung down. The service began.
Please,
can we say about Private First Class Mulligan? Marine Corps PFC Herman Mulligan, 21 years old, of West Greenville, South Carolina, was finally, at long last, accounted for on February 20th of this year. He was a member of Lima Company, 3rd Battalion, 22nd Marines, 6th Marine Division, engaged in heavy fighting against the Japanese on Hill 27 on the northern bank of the Tokuba Estuary, Okinawa, Japan. A large crypt loaded with ammunition exploded, wounding dozens and killing PFC Mulligan. Currently, there are still over 72,000 service members still unaccounted for from World War II. PFC Mulligan's name is recorded on the courts of the missing at the National Memorial Cemetery of the Pacific in Honolulu, along with the other MIAs from World War II. A rosette has now been placed next to his name, indicating that he has finally been accounted for.
The chaplain's words faded to white noise. I looked over the coffin in the direction of my parents' grave. The world seemed in black and white, except for the muted green of the grass. White tombstones stretched in all directions. I was glad it was raining. The day they buried my dad, it had been sunny. I wanted angry gods. After an 18-year quest, Herman was back on U.S. soil. Finally, he had a name on his grave.
They went with songs from the battle. They were young, straight of limb, true of eye, steady and aglow. They were staunch to the end against odds uncounted. They fell with their faces to the foe. They shall not grow old as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun and in the morning, we will remember them.
That's nearly one-third of my entire life trying to understand what happened and why it haunted my dad for decades. I'd completed his unfinished business, but I didn't feel a sense of triumph. I thought back to what he always said. There are no heroes. You just survive. As a boy, I never really understood those words. But now I realize exactly what he meant. He couldn't go back in time and change what happened that day of the explosion. And he couldn't bring Mulligan home. I'll never know for sure why he felt so guilty. My biggest theory is that he gave Mulligan the order to throw that grenade. He always said he fucked up, but they made him sergeant anyway. Forgetting was the only way he could cope. Forgetting was his way of surviving. For me and my brother Daryl, surviving meant something entirely different. It meant confronting the past, remembering the past.
For me, just letting it go and just saying, I forgive you. I just had to do that. Because otherwise, if I don't, I'm just churning it up in me. Now, if I say I forgive you, you're no longer part of this equation. Now you can fix me.
Was that with advice from the shrink, or did you just figure that out on your own?
No, I figured that one out on my own. I knew that. Because I knew it. If I don't forgive him and even Mama and myself, I'm never going to work on me. So, I just want you to bite the bullet and do it.
Right.
And mean it.
How's the work in progress going?
Slow. I get frustrated in the process going so slow.
So when did that process of self-healing, let's call it self-healing, when did that start?
Probably within the last maybe 3 years.
That recently?
Yeah.
This was my going to a shrink, understanding myself through the journey. I mean, I did discover a lot. And I've forgiven our father by a different route than you did. And maybe for different reasons. But I ended up with forgiveness by the time I stopped those interviews. And
you needed to have answers. I mean, that's your job. That's what you do. There was a mystery, and it needed to be unraveled. Who the hell is this guy in this picture that we've been looking at for 20 fucking years?
More. But no, but it was yeah, that's true. I agree. But it was also, it's old cliche, the journey. It's the journey, not the destination.
Right.
And meeting those guys, the privilege, the honor of those 29 guys and a dozen of them who are in the book, and their kids opening up. Spilling their guts, being on. I could have the conversation with those guys we couldn't have with our father.
Right. See, that's the conversation I really didn't care about.
This struck me hard, but part of me felt exactly the same as my brother. My 5-year-old self still resented our father for what he did to our mother, for the blood on the carpet. But now, after so many years of searching for the man in the picture, I found compassion for him. Blast concussions literally broke his brain. That's what led to his raging fits. I had to believe that wasn't really him. I haven't had nightmares about my dad in many years. Now when he shows up in my dreams, he's simply present. I see him, but he never speaks. He's peaceful. So I guess I'm healing too. But I won't use the word closure, a word I hate. Closure doesn't exist. It implies erasure. Herman died young and never got to come home and have a life. My father spent his life suffering from undiagnosed traumatic brain injury. My mom suffered. I simply felt empty. But Daryl saw something beautiful.
It makes my father whole again. It gives him back what he lost in the war. I mean, if you want to look at it metaphorically, Mulligan dying in the war took part of my father with him. He came home. He was lost, and now he's home. We're whole.
In memory of Jim Lockridge, Captain Frank Hagler, Tom Price, Fenton Gabby Grainert, James Patterson, Studs Terkel, Yoshikuni Yamada, Joan and Steve Maharaj, Herman Walter Mulligan. This has been an Audible Originals production of The Dead Drink First, written by Dale Maharaj, produced by Emily Martinez, sound designed by Tim Kim, fact-checked by Andrew Tchaikovsky, executive producers Mike Charzik, Andy Kiefer, and Jess Radburn. Copyright 2019 by Dale Maharaj. Production copyright 2019 by Audible Originals LLC.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.